listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Fear and Loathing in Riyadh by Bradley Hope. But under MBS, who has espoused a more liberal and personal form of Islam, Al-Ula has become the center of a high-end cultural explosion. Each year, its contemporary performing arts center, Mariah, nestled in a canyon and clad completely in mirrors, hosts events for the winter at Tantora Festival. On his second visit in early 2023, Depp was invited to MBS's royal camp in the mountains, with trained falcons, luxury tents, and an outdoor kitchen tended by dozens of staff, all accompanied by sweeping views. He also flew on multiple occasions by helicopter to MBS's yacht, Serene, one of the largest in the world. The 439-foot vessel mostly travels around the Red Sea as part of a floating palace complex, with as many as a dozen other smaller boats providing additional space for guests and crew. Depp always brings his guitar, according to a person familiar with the visits. The yacht is set up to serve as a mobile statehouse. MBS hosted Secretary of State John Kerry there in 2015, but with the touch of a few buttons, it can be turned into a nightclub with state-of-the-art DJ equipment. MBS and many of his advisors are night owls, staying up all night and sleeping well into the day. It's a habit that MBS acquired as a teenager, and some, like his younger brother Khalid bin Salman, the defense minister, find it helpful to be on the same schedule as counterparts in the U.S. Depp likes to burn the midnight oil, too, and he and MBS would stay up late talking about the Crown Prince's plans for Saudi Arabia and Depp's thoughts on how to bring more art and filmmaking to the country. At one point, Depp gave the prince a painting he'd made. One night, Depp summoned the courage to ask a simple but potentially explosive question. What really happened with Khashoggi? A veteran journalist with ties to both Saudi intelligence and the Muslim Brotherhood, Khashoggi had been living in Turkey and the U.S. and had become an increasingly vocal critic of MBS's rule, chastising the Crown Prince in the Washington Post and elsewhere for the war in Yemen and his aggressive moves to silence critics on both sides of the political spectrum. In October 2018, Khashoggi visited the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to obtain paperwork that would allow him to marry his Turkish fiancée. Once inside, he was drugged, killed, and dismembered by Saudi operatives. A listening device installed by the Turkish government captured the cold-blooded murder in excruciating detail. Its release shattered the image of MBS internationally and led to a widespread, if unofficial and inconsistent, boycott of all things Saudi for a few years. Joe Biden promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state in the run-up to the 2020 election. MBS denied ordering the hit, but admitted he was ultimately responsible for Khashoggi's death. Many of those involved in the operation were put on trial, and several were sentenced to prison. For about 3 years, MBS reduced his travel and focused inwardly on his Vision 2030 plan. Observers speculated that his family would remove him from power and return Saudi Arabia to its traditionally glacial status quo. They were wrong. By 2022, the furor had subsided enough that MBS felt comfortable answering Depp's question. With an earnest expression, MBS began laying out his argument that Khashoggi had become a rogue operative, working with the country's enemies to undermine the Crown Prince's reform agenda. The West saw Khashoggi as a journalist, MBS said, but the royal court viewed him as a corrupt enemy of the state, putting its future at risk for hidden motives. MBS said that his staff had been ordered to arrest Khashoggi on criminal charges if the opportunity arose, but that the directive had been misunderstood by overeager underlings who believed the prince would be happy if Khashoggi were silenced permanently. Consistent with his public statements, MBS told Depp he didn't order the murder, but nonetheless took responsibility. The CIA said in a confidential assessment that it believed with high confidence MBS ordered the killing, the Washington Post and the New York Times reported in 2018. The bromance is now in full gear, people close to Depp say, and naturally, being close to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has its benefits. Depp maintains to anyone he discusses the topic with that he values the friendship for what it is and doesn't want anything in return. But to secure Depp's assistance in putting Saudi Arabia on the cultural map, his team is in talks with the Saudi government about an annual seven-figure deal for him to attend events and shoot films in the country. In December, he attended the Red Sea Film Festival for the regional premiere of Jean du Barry. Earlier in the year, the Red Sea Film Foundation, through its financing arm, announced an investment in Depp's next directorial effort, Modi, about Italian artist Amedeo Modigliani. As part of the arrangement, Saudi interns have worked on the project across every department. The plot of the film, which stars Al Pacino and the Italian actor Riccardo Scamarcio in the title role, bears some semblance to Depp's own recent personal and professional journey. It takes place over 2 days as Modigliani hits rock bottom, drunkenly alienating those closest to him. According to a press release from the Red Sea Film Foundation, the chaos reaches a crescendo when he's faced with a collector who could change his life.
Thank you.
Deep State by Adam Schiralsky, with photographs by Philip Montgomery. In secret undersea locations, America's fleet of nuclear submarines silently prepares for the next superpower conflict. Gaining unprecedented access to these rarely glimpsed vessels and their commanders, Vanity Fair reports on the linchpin of the nation's strategic arsenal. Opening photo, a nuclear sub surfaces to take aboard a commander doing a spot inspection. Under cover of darkness, I boarded a Navy vessel at a heavily guarded military base along the eastern seaboard. The location and time of departure, as well as the direction and distance of travel, were unknown to me. Adding to the sense of secrecy, a towering sailor in camouflage stood in the rain, examining my belongings for electronics that might leave a digital trail an adversary could intercept and exploit. Buffeted by strong winds and high Atlantic seas, the support ship sailed through the night for more than 15 storm-tossed hours toward a destination somewhere off the continental shelf. Just after dawn, a sleek, inky object appeared in the distance, right above the waterline. It was the protruding bridge of what sailors call a boomer, a submarine armed to the gills with nuclear missiles, which is considered the most lethal, stealthy, and survivable weapon in America's strategic arsenal. Photographer Philip Montgomery and I had been granted permission to chronicle life aboard a boomer at a perilous time. Our embed was unique. The arms and technology on board, along with the ship's routines and missions, are among the government's most closely guarded secrets. We'd been told that the number of civilians who had been given this level of access, carrying cameras no less, was roughly the same as that who have walked on the moon. Last summer, when I'd placed a request for the voyage, America was confronting two superpower threats: Beijing's increasingly bold advances in the South China Sea and Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Then, in October, the Israel-Hamas war added new urgency. U.S. warships were drawn to the region, projecting force in case the conflict escalated. In short order, American vessels began intercepting long-range missiles that Iranian-supplied Yemeni rebels fired on Israel and on the ships themselves. When other Tehran-backed militias attacked U.S. outposts in Iraq, Syria, and then Jordan, killing three service members in late January, it was apparent the reprisals from American fighter jets had not been a sufficient deterrent. President Biden, with carrier strike groups already in place, decided to retaliate forcefully on multiple targets. Next photos, wayfarers, a sailor among torpedo tubes, a launch detonator, the above-water suitcase used for communication between an officer and deckhands. In October, we'd been slated to board a sub in, of all places, the Middle East. But when American vessels came under attack, our trip was scrubbed. You'd have been out at sea for months, one of our handlers worried. In November, though, we were given short notice to fly to a southern city in the U.S., where we would be met, escorted to a ship, and then ferried to a boomer. A senior officer, we were told, was heading out to conduct an evaluation of a rookie submarine captain, and we would be along to observe. The sub would surface for a short time, so as not to draw unwanted attention. We were to climb aboard, and the ship would submerge. To prepare, I had interviewed more than 24 current officials responsible for U.S. nuclear doctrine and warfare. And as I looked at the hulking slash on the horizon, the words of one naval captain resonated with me. When a single boomer goes out to sea, it does so as the sixth largest nuclear nation on Earth. Now, literally in the middle of nowhere, we made our rendezvous. A lashing rain seemed to be coming at us sideways, but suddenly, as we approached the sub, the sun broke through. Idling on our starboard like some leviathan loomed the missile deck of the USS Wyoming, A multi-billion dollar behemoth that is slightly longer than the Washington Monument is tall, the ship can carry up to 160 thermonuclear warheads, roughly the same firepower as India, a country that has been stockpiling nuclear arms for half a century. As wars, hot and cold, visible and invisible, were being waged on land and at sea, it felt like an opportune time to meet the men, the women, and the weapons system that, in Pentagon terms, provide 24/7 deterrence to prevent catastrophic actions from our adversaries. The military's rationale for offering us access seemed clear. The brass, apparently, wanted to help get Americans accustomed to the increasingly real prospect of conflict with a genuinely powerful opponent. They wanted to humanize the otherwise inhuman. Some would say inhumane reality of nuclear deterrence. And finally, they wanted to convey a message to China and Russia about U.S. forces and their strategic capabilities, resolve, and for the moment at least, superiority. Sublord, as the ominous backstop to America's national security, the Department of Defense relies on a triad: intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, long-range bombers, and submarines. The latter are considered the triad's least vulnerable leg and carry 70% of all deployed nuclear warheads in the inventory. Boomers are officially known as Ohio-class SSBNs, Navy speak for submersible ship ballistic nuclear, and were built, as even the junior-most sailor will tell you without a hint of irony, to preserve the peace, and in the event of strategic attack, to inflict unimaginable destruction. We are prepared to unleash hell, Admiral William Houston told me, adding that, of course, we never want to do it. Those sailors know if their weapon system is ever used, they are probably not coming home to their families. And so they take their business very, very seriously. It's what we refer to as a no-fail mission. You are working directly for the president when you're out there. Starting in 2021, Houston, 55, headed the U.S. submarine force, 25,000 strong, involved in the operation of 65 subs, and the Allied Submarine Command, which made him the principal undersea warfare advisor to all of NATO's strategic commanders. Awarded his fourth star in December, he became director of the Navy and Energy Department's Nuclear Naval Reactor Program, a position once held by Admiral Hyman Rickover, a towering, if controversial, figure who is considered the father of the nuclear navy. While boomers may be the deadliest ships at sea, the sub-command also operates Virginia-class hunter-killer subs, SSNs, which track and are prepared to sink enemy subs and surface ships, as well as guided missile subs, SSGNs, among them the USS Florida, which in early November popped up in the Middle East. The Florida's very public passage through the Suez Canal, Houston insisted, was a message to remind people that you have an incredible warship right there that you can't do anything about. We're telling our adversaries, you have to be aware of its destructive capability if leadership decides to use it. This was no idle threat. In January, after myriad attacks by the Houthis, Iran's Yemen-based proxy army, against vessels flying a variety of flags, American officials, in a tandem strike with the UK, ordered the Florida to launch Tomahawk missiles at Houthi targets. My predecessors, some of them call themselves Underlord, Houston explained, a reference to mythic characters in the multiverse, and that has a dark connotation. The Admiral added with a grin, I'm just waiting for somebody to give me some respect and call me Sublord. I'm a huge Marvel fan. His staff ribbingly slapped the moniker on his parking spot in front of his Norfolk, Virginia headquarters. Next photo, modern mariners. Navy personnel stand watch on the USS Wyoming's bridge. And, In a rainstorm, the vessel briefly emerges to meet a support ship. Houston's path to the Navy was unexpected. In high school in Buffalo, he and some buddies ditched lunch on a hot day to hang out in the college guidance office, the only spot with air conditioning. They pretended to be flipping through ROTC applications when they were called on the carpet by an administrator who, as Houston recalled, told them that they could stay so long as they completed the paperwork. Houston wound up with a ROTC scholarship to Notre Dame and during a month-long voyage to Japan fell in love with submarine culture. "So yeah, I'm in the Navy because I skipped lunch," he deadpanned. Later, when we returned to the subject, he observed, "When people ask me why I am in the military, I go to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. There is evil in the world. There is pure, unadulterated evil." 2 decades ago, as a deputy squadron commander, he helped integrate women into the all-male submarine service. The Wyoming, he noted, was an early target for the task, since its namesake was the first state to allow women's suffrage. The goal, moving forward, is for every ship to be gender-agnostic in its commands and roles. Nearly all Ohio-class subs are emblazoned with the name of a U.S. state. The admiral spoke admiringly of the boat to which we'd been assigned. "Wyoming is the most powerful warship ever created," he told me. "It is the ultimate guarantor of our strategic deterrence." Hidden in its hull are 20 Trident II D-5 ballistic missiles, tipped with independently targetable warheads, each with many times the destructive power of the bombs dropped on Japan in World War II. "Tridents are so accurate," Houston said, "they can hit a stadium on the other side of the globe." The central mission of the service's 14 boomers is to clandestinely plumb the world's oceans, waiting to respond if ever an enemy, for whatever reason, including a fit of pique or miscalculation, initiates a first strike. At that point, the president could decide to order the Wyoming or one of its fellow subs to launch in retaliation. For further context, I dropped in on a Navy captain named Dan Packer. His assessment was even more blunt than Houston's. "My job is to come up with ways to kill people, and to find friends to help me kill people," he said when we first met. Until October, he was the director of plans and policy for the subforce, responsible for writing the playbook for undersea warfare, and has stayed on as a top civilian advisor. During his career, he served on 4 classes of submarine before returning to his alma mater, the Naval Academy, as Dean of Math and Science. The man is a bit of a legend, a sailor and a scholar who literally grew up in the shadow of the Atomic Enterprise in a small South Carolina town just down the road from the Savannah River site, where, since the 1950s, reactors have churned out plutonium and tritium for warheads. On 9/11, Packer, then a lieutenant commander, was the engineer officer on the USS Ohio, an SSBN that was in the Pacific for a worldwide war game. Early that morning, the captain took to the PA to prepare the crew for the drill. 30 minutes later, Packer said, the commander picked up the mic again to say, "Cancel the exercise. The United States is under attack." Over the next few hours, the Ohio received fragmentary reports. The Twin Towers had been hit. The Pentagon had been struck, true, and destroyed, not true. They also understood that the president was airborne, another portentous sign to those who wait on orders from the National Command Authority, which the president directs. The Ohio, Packer recalled, began the march from DEFCON 5 to 4 to 3. "You take actions to make the platform more ready to complete its mission. You open safes and look at and access war plans that are normally not known or accessible." When I asked how unusual those actions were, he replied, "I'd never seen those things, ever." Sailors on the Ohio began to speculate about who was behind the attacks. The consensus on the boat was that it was Iran. "And as far as we were concerned, they were going to be radioactive glass," Packer remarked. painting an image of the hellscape that would result if the tridents were launched. If you ever wonder if people would be ready to employ these weapons, the answer is yes. When I mentioned to a senior national security official that I was meeting with the country's top nuclear strategist, his eyes went wide. "Get ready for some straight talk," he advised. "They never let these guys out of the cage. They aren't supposed to talk to anyone, so if you have them, expect to get an earful." Packer, like so many others interviewed for this story, told me he is bracing for a very different battle than the ones fought in the aftermath of 9/11. 2027 is the year Xi Jinping said they need to be ready to go to war, he noted, referencing China's president. "We use that as a benchmark." With that date only 3 years off, Packer is now the sub-force's civilian lead on AUKUS, a trilateral security pact through which the U.S. and U.K. are helping Australia field a fleet of nuclear subs in an attempt to check China's ambitions. He is also working on incorporating AI into aircraft that scour the South China Sea for acoustic signatures emanating from Beijing subs. While public attention is focused on Ukraine and the Middle East, the Western submarine community is busy analyzing the threat posed by China's industrial base, which is churning out surface ships and undersea vessels at an astounding clip. The Chinese Navy, in fact, is the world's largest, consisting of more than 370 vessels. American shipyards simply cannot keep pace. The good news, Packer and others believe, is that for all its capacity, Chinese naval prowess, when it comes to submarines and seasoned sailors, is lacking. While that could change, it is unlikely to do so, many experts contend on Xi's timeline. That gives America's so-called silent service an advantage. In the Taiwan fight, Packer maintained, we're prepared to go into the jaws of the Chinese undersea forces and take them all out. All the surface ships as well. Next photos, stealth voyage, an empty torpedo tube, and the ship's sail. Black hull, orange tubes. On the voyage out to the Wyoming, I was accompanied by Commander David Burke, 42, the deputy of Submarine Squadron 20, a seat Houston once occupied. Burke was coming out to conduct a spot inspection to make sure the crew and its new commanding officer, CO, were up to snuff. Burke would know. In February 2022, while in charge of an Atlantic Fleet boomer, the USS Rhode Island, he received an urgent message that Russia was invading Ukraine. If the U.S. made certain moves, Vladimir Putin soon warned, forces might be met with a nuclear response. That was a turning point, he recalled, a serious reminder of why our job is so important on an SSBN. Months later, when Burke surfaced the Rhode Island and Gibraltar, the meaning was clear. America's boomers can show up anywhere, anytime. Last July, the USS Kentucky, a sister ship assigned to the Pacific, made a port call in Busan, South Korea. The first such visit in more than 40 years. As our support ship approached the Wyoming, Burke, a plain-spoken Illinoisan with piercing blue eyes, was candid about the sacrifices submariners make by being out of touch for long stretches. I have an 8-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. Through her 4th birthday, I was probably gone 50% of her life. So it's tough, he conceded. If I'm going to be away from my family, I want it to be both professionally rewarding and challenging. He was less candid about his accomplishments. Only later did I learn that Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first woman to head naval operations in the service's 248-year history, had just given him the coveted Stockdale Award, presented annually to the most inspiring leaders in the Navy. In short, the sub-force command was sending a golden boy to put the Wyoming through its paces, with a Vanity Fair reporter and photographer in tow. The new CO was about to be tested in real time and on the record. After a night and a morning at sea, our embarkation had arrived. As Whitecaps crashed against the Wyoming's hull, Burke went aboard first. I followed, traversing a rickety drawbridge from ship to ship, aided by a line of sailors fanned out across the sub's vast deck. Some were toting automatic weapons, a precaution when a boomer is on the surface. A rescue diver was ready if a swell took one of us overboard. The ship's slightly curved surface, like a giant whale's, was matte black, covered with special material that absorbs sound waves and masks the craft's sonar signature. The hull itself was punctuated with two rows of 12 round lids, like giant manhole covers. These ominous circles were the exit doors for the Trident missiles below. Upon reaching the hatch, I carefully descended several vertical ladders that were slick with sea spray. Stepping off, it felt like I was stepping back in time. I was surrounded by walls with exposed pipes, old-school circuitry, panels full of analog dials, switches, and gauges. It felt part boiler room, part brewery, part mad scientist lab from a 1950s sci-fi film. The explanation: when the devices on this class of sub were devised in the 70s and 80s, they were quite modern. Some have been upgraded. Others remain unchanged. One uses a crank because they're reliable, durable, and easy to replace at sea. Here and there, I passed men and women in coveralls who were receiving instructions on throwback speakers and talking into vintage telephones. Save for the advanced systems in the control and sonar rooms, bristling with screens labeled secret and top secret, everything about the boat, down to the Wyoming's stated mission to be on scene and unseen, harkened back to the Cold War. Maybe, I thought, we were being cast in the sequel. Or maybe the original never ended. My first impressions were predictable. The ship seemed cramp, with narrow passageways. I was surprised, though, that the boomer's four decks, with 14-foot ceilings, also made it seem cavernous, even airy, in certain spots. Offsetting the retro-tech vibe were odd trinkets hanging from the walls. Cowboy boots, lariats, spurs. This was, after all, the Wyoming, and as a way of paying homage to the state and providing a touch of home, these voyagers had gone out of their way to set a Western tone to the decor. The ship's motto, I soon discovered, was Cowboy Up. And ever since the boat was commissioned in 1996, crew members have made pilgrimages to the state, meeting officials and supporters and taking in the rodeo. In short order, we were cruising at dozens of miles an hour and depths of several hundred feet, and unavoidably, the missiles remained front of mind. Every few steps I encountered what looked like curved walls painted orange. These were the missile tubes, as massive as the trunks of redwoods. An arms control pact with the Russians dictates that only 20 of the 24 missile tubes can be operable. I also toured the torpedo room where the Mark 48s, with their 650-pound high-explosive warheads, are stored. The missile tubes were ubiquitous, so much so that the bathrooms and crew quarters were situated right beside them. In fact, the compartment where I would spend the night, which contained six small curtained-off bunks, as if on a train's sleeper car, was effectively wedged between two Tridents. Chessmaster, those orange tubes, those missiles, were the reason I was now hours from shore. But to understand their use, I wanted to meet the man who was in day-to-day control of them. And to that end, a month before my voyage, I paid a visit to landlocked Omaha. There, I was invited into the buzzing corridors of the U.S. Strategic Command, STRATCOM, the nerve center of America's nuclear arsenal, located at Offutt Air Force Base. This is the place that produced the Enola Gay and Boxcar, the B-29s that dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the place where President George W. Bush had taken temporary refuge on 9/11. When I arrived, I spotted mechanics attending to two aircraft on the tarmac. One was an E-6B Mercury, a nondescript plane that, if needed, can serve as both a communications relay for ballistic missile subs, like the Wyoming, and as an airborne launch control for land-based ICBMs. Nearby was a heavily militarized version of a Boeing 747, the E-4B Night Watch, which houses the National Airborne Operations Center, which, according to its mission statement, provides a highly survivable command, control, and communication center in case of national emergency or destruction of ground command and control centers. Its nickname, the Doomsday Plane. STRATCOM, with its 150,000 service members and civilians, is led by an Air Force four-star, General Anthony Cotton, who ushered me through his sprawling outer office, swarming with airmen, sailors, soldiers, and Marines, before taking me into his inner sanctum, a hushed wood-paneled oasis in the eye of the storm. Cotton, along with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin III and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs General Charles Brown, Jr., is part of a trio of black leadership atop America's national security pyramid. And it was a point of pride, clearly, that of all the black four-stars, as Cotton told me, there's only been 10 in the history of the Air Force, and I'm number 10. I asked what drew him to the service. Simple, he said, walking over to a display case containing a folded flag with a picture next to it. That's my dad. He joined in 1942. As you can see, he was a diamond-wearing African-American that was in World War II in the Army Air Corps, made the transition to the Air Force, and retired as a Chief Master Sergeant in 1974. So I came out of the womb as a member of the military. He was emotional as he recalled how in 2000 his father passed away a month to the day after his mother. He didn't see me make Lieutenant Colonel, but I buried him with my promotion recommendation form. I found Cotton from Goldsboro, North Carolina, to be open, gregarious, and quick to laugh, traits that might seem at odds with the solemnity of his mission. I don't want to walk the walls or the halls of the Pentagon, and when people see me, they're like, oh, there's General Cotton, the nuclear guy, he said. Cotton, 60, recounted how he'd first felt the weight of command as a 22-year-old on his inaugural ride out to a missile field in Minot, North Dakota. You're jumping in that Suburban, he said, knowing that you're responsible to execute under presidential authorities the most powerful weapon on the face of the globe. You see the humming of the launch control center, and you see 10 green lights, and know that on the other side of that green light is a Minuteman III with warheads on board. It all becomes real at that point. Cotton would eventually hold a string of lofty leadership posts, most recently running the Air Force Global Strike Command, responsible for the country's bombers and ICBMs. His job as STRATCOM chief, preparing, and if necessary, turning to the tools at his disposal, from conventional long-range strike weapons and multi-platform nuclear arms to joint electromagnetic spectrum operations, which involve exploiting and attacking enemy frequencies, as well as protecting our own. Being able to provide those options to the commander-in-chief is what I do, he explained, before taking stock of the geopolitical moment. That's important, especially now as we see the threat vectors to rules-based international order. Translation, over the second half of the last century, Western national security officials were preoccupied with trying to keep one adversary, the USSR, in check, even as the dueling nuclear powers ratified landmark arms control treaties. With those efforts now in eclipse and nuclear proliferation a chilling reality, America and its allies are currently contending with two near-peer opponents, Russia and China, as well as their own set of allies with nuclear aspirations, including North Korea Iran, and by extension the Axis of Resistance, a term that encompasses armed groups like the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, and the Popular Mobilization Forces in Iraq. That's quite a roster. Next, photo, C-suite. Missile keys adorn lanyards and missile tubes. In the command center, sailors dive and steer the ship as an officer looks on. Who, I wondered, did Cotton have on speed dial? He chortled at the question before turning it back around. Who do you think? He then showed me a bank of phones with buttons for, among others, Biden, Austin, Brown, the leadership of the U.S. intelligence community, and the 10 combatant commanders who, along with Cotton, command and deploy the nation's armed forces. Are you the guy nobody wants to hear from? I ask, half in jest. Yeah, actually, it does kind of suck, he said with a smile. Next photo, Leviathan, the Wyoming at an undisclosed location in the Atlantic. Along the length of the four-story ship runs an array of missile tubes, their circular exit doors ominously visible on the hull. Shortly before my visit, the Florida had made its presence known in the Suez. Only hours after I departed, the B-21 Raider, which will replace the B-2 as a strategic bomber, made its first public flight. Cotton was eager to convey the range of options he can summon if required. Missiles, bombers, subs. For me, being the chess master, and being able to offer those effects, if warranted, is incredibly important. Because at the end of the day, I'm supposed to be able to hold people at risk, and I can do that with the triad. Still, the chess master doesn't sleep soundly. Even at the height of the Cold War, you had conversations with your adversaries, Cotton said, alluding to the Red Phone, a hotline set up in 1963 between Washington and Moscow that allowed dialogue and de-escalation in times of crisis. We're not seeing that with China. I would love to have my counterpart come visit me to understand what we're doing so there's no miscalculation. In December, Brown spoke with a top Chinese general about re-establishing ad hoc communication, which Beijing had suspended after the U.S. shot down a Chinese spy balloon. Subspecies. In the Wyoming's wardroom, I met Jeremy Garcia, the sub's new CO. Like others who hold the rank of commander and helm a sub, he is addressed as captain on board. Burke was cordial to Garcia, but he was also there to give an unvarnished evaluation, so he hung back a bit. Garcia, 44, tall and bearing an uncanny resemblance to a young Tim Robbins, had not been given much notice about our visit or the decision to pair it with Burke's drop-by. But he seemed like the kind who rolled with the punches. He'd already had his trial by fire. His first week on active patrol at sea, Hamas and Israel had gone to war, and the Wyoming was prepped in case it might be tagged for duty there, if only to surface and convey a strategic message. Garcia was unflustered and welcoming. Off the bat, he urged me to speak with any of the 163 sailors on board, without any PR minders. I then accompanied him around his ship. A Bellevue, Washington native, he'd enlisted in 1998 as a nuclear engineering and electronics technician. He made his bones on fast attack and ballistic missile subs before finally assuming the Wyoming's reins. The best part of the gig, he told me, is growing an amazingly talented and proficient team of warriors. Talented, indeed. The threshold for a billet on a boomer is, in part, one's range. Crew members must be comfortable spending months in a confined space, typically 70 to 100 days, pitching in on various assignments and being knowledgeable about nuclear physics. Before submariners receive their insignia, a patch or pin showing a sub flanked by marine creatures, they must earn their fish, demonstrating proficiency as first responders across departments, ever mindful of the threat posed by fire or a breach in the hull. Cooks, for example, can serve as EMTs if a sailor ever needs treatment by the onboard medic, who runs what amounts to an urgent care clinic. The wardroom can be converted into an operating theater. With elaborate systems for swapping in crews and rations, subs, unless they require maintenance, can conceivably remain at sea indefinitely during times of heightened tension. Walking the ship, I met mariners who were Asian, Black, Latino, immigrants, first-generation Americans, third-generation sailors, and so on. This was a point of pride for the captain and the sub-force. And yet the culture has become so ingrained that merely inquiring about it, or the 13-year effort to integrate women on subs, was met with eye rolls. A distinct message was coming through to me: the perils and impediments of life underwater trivialized any fissures that might otherwise exist on land. A submarine is always trying to kill you, and our job is trying not to die, asserted Jonathan O'Melian, a salty missile technician, who noted that crew members were united in purpose. The reason that we are out here is so that we have a place to come home to. We are pretty much the big guys standing up to the bullies saying, hey, excuse my language, F off, don't F with us. We are bigger, we are better. His ship's leader has a command philosophy that might seem counterintuitive to those on shore. I'm a big fan of pushing responsibility down to the lowest level, Garcia said, and the lowest level does not mean rank. It means technical expertise and experience. So, if that means a very important program can be run by a first tour individual of any rank, then I'm fine with that, as long as they own it. The job of diving and steering, for example, is not in the captain's remit. He has put that chore in the hands of the junior-most people, albeit with a senior officer seated behind them. Garcia, like a dozen other COs I spoke to, takes people who are too young to legally drink, metaphorically drops them in the deep end, and says swim. True, other branches of the military imbue airmen, soldiers, and Marines with outsized responsibility, but I am hard-pressed to think of another mission as daunting as testing a teenager's mettle underwater with a nuclear reactor in back and thermonuclear warheads in front. Beyond their duties, the Gen Zers and the millennials who supervise them must contend with a life that is practically monastic. They are completely removed from meaningful connectivity, including social media. Their only contact with the outside world involves infrequent and heavily monitored emails with family when the sub is at a depth and a posture that permit it. There is also little privacy beyond the confines of a draped bunk that can feel like a coffin. Deprived of many other creature comforts, sailors can avail themselves of exercise gear, which is spread around the boat, including treadmills and free weights, but not when the sub is running silent so as to evade detection. When I first entered the command and control room, called the con, a young ensign named Kirsten Barber was moving with purpose between banks of displays and the sub's twin periscopes. She was standing watch, scanning for vessels, on the surface or submerged, that might approach the sub or compromise its position. Knowing that we're out here, basically keeping the entire United States safe, she told me, is pretty awesome, actually. Barber answers to the nickname Chop, a title submariners assign the chief supply officer, a job vital to the ship's operation and the crew's morale. Some of the smartest people I've met are younger than me, Barber said, gesturing toward the stern. I'm 23, and there are some people back aft running a nuclear reactor that just blow me away every day. They have to be smart to be on this boat. I was reminded of a conversation I had when I first visited Subforce Command. Over lunch, a young Annapolis grad, an astrophysicist who evidently has a couple of satellites named after her, discussed her plans to possibly switch gears and become an astronaut. She was reciting, rather than bragging about her time at school and at sea, When a captain sitting next to her piped in wryly, "I have the same credentials, other than the satellites." At one point on the trip, I found myself marveling over, of all things, a biscuit. Not only was it gluten-free, it was delicious. When I shared my surprise with Barbara, she beamed. Of all her roles, none looms larger than overseeing the galley. She took me on a tour of the cavernous refrigeration and freezer compartments that are manned by Jack of the Dust, the sobriquet of the sailor, bedecked in winterized gear, in charge of provisions storage. Virtually everyone I interviewed on the Wyoming raved about the food, which is an atypical reaction when it comes to military chow. There is a reason for that. Among the ship's secret weapons is culinary specialist Chief Petty Officer Earl White. Raised in Granville, Ohio, White followed in his grandfather's steps, starting his career as a butcher before going to culinary school. In 2009, he joined the Navy and served for 6 years on Burke's old boat, the Rhode Island, before taking a land-based assignment. "I did 4 years at Camp David," he recounted, "while kneading dough in the galley." The Navy also runs the White House dining room, famously referred to as the Mess. "I did 2 years of Obama, 2 years of Trump. It was an incredible experience." White not only served first families and VIPs, he also earned prestigious gourmet certifications. While we were underway, he whipped up bisque and beignets. For one lunch, we had a Mexican spread. Even at sea, they called it Taco Tuesday. I shared meals in the wardroom with Burke, Garcia, his deputy Ben Reed, and several junior officers. We dined on oxtail, salmon, and winter vegetables, served on proper Navy china. After supper, Burke and Garcia teamed up in a fierce smack-talking game of cribbage against other Navy visitors. But the main event, as all of us knew, was how Garcia would be judged by his cribbage comrade Burke. Top officials can issue all the orders they want, but someone has to push the buttons, quite literally. And so the climactic moment aboard the Wyoming came when Garcia and company engaged in a command and control exercise, CCX, replicating the exact and exacting procedures required to deploy the sub's deadly payload. For much of the voyage, I'd noticed that Burke, silent but affable, would appear and then drift away to assess crew members on their navigation skills, their weapons preparedness, and their engineering prowess. Now, with Burke watching from the wings, the CCX commenced. As planned, a simulated emergency action message, EAM, came in from the National Command Authority. The message was received by the communications team, led by 27-year-old Lieutenant Michael Gomez, whom everyone calls Cummo. He was quickly joined by another junior officer, and using their thumbs and forefingers, they jointly grasped the EAM, a plastic object about the size of a playing card. And the men facing each other walked sideways across the con. The reason for this unusual choreography? The nuclear command and control process requires two-person integrity, theoretically ensuring that there be redundant affirmation should a worst-case EAM ever be received, until the imaginable moment a missile might be released. When the pair reached the spot where Garcia was standing, they could see that resting on his hip were scores of keys that were wrapped around his frame like a tangle of Christmas lights. The COO has lanyards that contain keys needed to carry out very specific processes to support any missile launch, a senior Navy officer explained. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Colexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.